Hi, Marco Werman here. One of the things we pride ourselves on at The World is our approach to the news. The stories are often interconnected and complex, but we know you get it. Our key areas of focus, such as migration, climate change, public health, and global security, often have ripple effects. Because of the time and care we invest in our reporting, our correspondents are able to draw out these important connections for you. Take Carolyn Beeler's reporting that connected the war in Ukraine with European climate targets, or Halima Gakande's reporting on the impact extreme drought in Somalia has on migration, or Joy Hackel's superb work as a producer, lining up people for me to speak with all across Ukraine. Listener support helps us connect you each day with the news. If you've already donated, thank you so much for investing in our work. If you haven't donated and you value the independent, nuanced journalism from The World, I hope you'll make a gift today. You can donate at theworld.org/give or follow the link in our episode notes. And if you're able, I hope you'll consider making a monthly donation to keep us going all year long. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give. Thanks. And now, the show.
Beijing is flexing its muscle in the Taiwan Strait and hopes Taiwan takes note of what's happening in Ukraine.
Look, we told you so. The United States will not actually commit its troops militarily to defend you either.
Also ahead, suspicious deaths in Iran. Two scientists became suddenly ill and died.
Every once in a while we have an assassination, all in sensitive sectors of the Iranian industries, military, aerospace.
Iran says Israel is to blame. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also on today's show, air pollution in Southeast Asia is taking a toll on human health. And morning runs.
On some of the bad days, what's it like to come running out here?
On a bad day, I don't come. You can feel it in your throat after a while.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler, in for Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for spending some time with us today. The future of Taiwan is looking increasingly precarious. The U.S. and other nations routinely sail warships through the Taiwan Strait. But this week, China's foreign ministry issued a statement saying the strait is not part of international waters. And China's president, Xi Jinping, has signed an order that allows military operations beyond China's borders. This could be just a ratcheting up of rhetoric, or it could be a step closer to something much more dangerous. To help us unravel all of this, we reached out to Kevin Rudd. He's the former Prime Minister of Australia and now head of the Asia Society. First off, Prime Minister, China's statement this week saying that the Taiwan Strait is not part of international waters. Is this a shift by Beijing?
It is a shift. It remains to be seen, however, the extent to which it represents a shift in operational behavior by China's naval and air operations in that stretch of water.
And you could hear echoes here in Xi Jinping's statement and Vladimir Putin's labeling of Russia's invasion of Ukraine a special military operation. Do you see any link here?
No, I don't see any particular link there. China's strategy towards Taiwan has been on its own railroad tracks, if you like, for quite some time. China's preparations, both militarily, financially, economically, dealing with the future contingency of sanctions, this has been underway for quite some period of time. China will undertake a lessons learned exercise as they reflect on what went wrong for Putin in Russia. But I do not see either this action over the Taiwan Straits or more broadly their Taiwan strategy, is fundamentally shifting based on what has occurred in Ukraine.
You said they will undertake a lessons learned assessment. What do you think they might gather about the international reaction to Russia's invasion of Ukraine that might inform future thinking or actions on Taiwan?
One, in the surprise category, the extent to which there has been a high level of democratic world solidarity behind Ukraine. Although the other lessons learned is that the Chinese have emphasized in their own propaganda, particularly directed at Taiwan, that the United States did not commit military forces to assist the Ukraine in the field. And so the Chinese lesson, as they would take it for the Taiwanese, is, look, we told you so, the United States will not actually commit its troops militarily to defend you either. So that's one set of observations. I think there are two others very quickly. Another relates to Russia's lack of effective military preparedness, particularly joint operations between the various arms of the Russian armed forces. China, since 2015, has embarked upon a major military reorganization itself, bringing about joint command structures, a different orientation of its military regions, etc. So this will contribute to exercises they've already got underway. And then finally, their vulnerability to financial sanctions of the type which have been imposed against the Russians, and China's own plans for making themselves more resilient to those contingencies in the future as well.
Prime Minister Red, you've spent a lot of time in recent years trying to get into Xi Jinping's mindset. After leaving office in 2013, you actually went to Oxford University to study Xi's worldview. What do you think we in the U.S. or in the West more broadly are missing when we're trying to understand his stance both toward Taiwan and the U.S.?
Having read through much of what Xi Jinping has written, I think the thing that we perhaps do not understand fully or emphasize enough around the world is this. Xi Jinping, in his heart of hearts and mind of minds, is a committed Marxist-Leninist for whom Marxist-Leninist ideology actually matters fundamentally, not just as a series of ideological precepts about the inevitable victory of communism, etc., but also as a series of analytical methodologies, arcane concepts such as dialectical materialism and historical materialism, the way in which reality is viewed by the Chinese system led by Xi Jinping. If you read this stuff carefully enough, it occupies a very large part of the way in which China, under his leadership, views the world and China's future within it.
So if Xi uses these Marxist classics to guide his thinking, how should that inform how the West deals with him?
In Xi Jinping's worldview, as a believer in historical materialism and, let's call it, historical determinism, that is that history is on China's side, and that when he uses phrases like the rise of the East and the decline of the West, and phrases like China has now moved to the center of the world stage, these are not just fun phrases. They actually represent a deep set of ideological conclusions within the Chinese system. In terms of how the West should respond to that, understand that it is not just the personal self-confidence of Xi Jinping as a leader. He presides over a system which he has sought to educate into the view that history is on China's side.
You're one of the few Western leaders who's actually spent significant time with Xi, gotten to know him, spoken to him in his own language. Is there a particular story or anecdote or glimpse of him that you gathered in that time that you found especially revealing?
After long and intensive conversations with Xi Jinping over the years, the bottom line is that Xi Jinping is a highly intelligent individual. He's very well read in the history of his own country and the history of the Chinese Communist Party, phenomenally well versed in, let's call it, Marxist classics, a reasonable familiarity with his own literary tradition, and apart from all that, enormously self-confident. When I look at previous Chinese leaders in the post-Deng period, whether it's Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao, these two leaders were much more qualified in the way in which they viewed their role as international leaders, not Xi Jinping. I've never seen Xi Jinping refer to a note in a single conversation he's had with me. So confident is he of his brief, what he stands for, and where he intends to take the country.
No notes. It seems like there is this talk about what is China thinking about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But your analysis is that any real action on Taiwan from China's part will not come for several years. Is that right?
I see the 2020s and the early 2030s as the decade of living dangerously, simply because we currently have unmanaged strategic competition and about four or five sets of deeply exposed live wires running across the relationship, any one of which could catch fire at any given time. That's what concerns me about the decade ahead. I think Xi Jinping is moving in a direction whereby His own timetable for a deliberate action against Taiwan is late 20s, early 30s. Xi Jinping sees himself as a man of history, as being in the saddle in China's leadership, I think, through until the mid-30s, which means that he would want to see this done on his watch, unless the United States and Taiwan in particular have rebuilt effective military deterrence, so much so that China's military commanders would then formally advise Xi Jinping, no, the risk would be too great for China to contemplate this action at that stage.
Kevin Rudd is a former Prime Minister of Australia and now President and CEO of the Asia Society. He's the author of The Avoidable War, The Dangers of a Catastrophic Conflict Between the U.S. and Xi Jinping's China. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the program.
In Iran, government officials confirmed this week that two scientists died under mysterious circumstances. The news comes after a high-ranking Iranian military official was killed just last month. Iran is blaming Israel for assassinating key figures in its military and nuclear programs, and Israeli officials, they're not exactly denying it. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi visited the family of Colonel Hassan Sayed Khodayi this week. Khodayi was a high-ranking military official who was shot and killed outside his home in Tehran by two gunmen on motorcycles. According to the New York Times, American officials were informed by Israel that it was behind the killing, and that Khodayi was part of a covert team ordered to abduct and murder Israelis and other foreigners. Sitting on a couch next to Khodayi's teenage son, Raisi described the colonel as a martyr. He said the enemies of Iran carry out such assassinations as a sign of desperation. Raisi and other Iranian officials have had to pay a number of visits like this in recent years. Iranian scientists and military figures have been targets of assassinations. Sina Azadi is an Iran expert at George Washington University.
Every once in a while, we have an assassination, all in sensitive sectors of the Iranian industries, military, aerospace, commanders of IRGC.
The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is a branch of Iran's military. Azadi says these deaths are no coincidence. In recent years, there has been a concerted effort by those opposed to the government in Tehran to dismantle its nuclear and military programs. One way to do that, he says, has been to go after the brains behind them, and to do it from inside the country.
People commit espionage or this kind of operations for reasons. One is money.
Another, he says, is ideological.
You may have someone who's working for the government, but somehow secretly is opposed to the regime's policies.
And then, as Azadi says, there are those from minority groups that have experienced discrimination and who want to inflict damage on the government. Some operations are carried out more openly than others. There are the gunmen on motorcycles, but then there are those that are more murky. This week, Iranian officials announced two new deaths, one an aerospace expert and the other a geologist. They said Ayub Entezari and Kamran Aghamulai were young and healthy, but both suddenly fell ill last month and died shortly after. Officials say their food was poisoned. Mayor Javed Anfar, an Iran expert in Tel Aviv, says Israel hasn't officially taken responsibility for these deaths, but the assassinations align with something that former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has talked about in the past, the octopus doctrine.
He says that the Islamic Republic of Iran is like an octopus. The head is the Islamic Republic, and the tentacles are Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and all the other organizations.
For many years, Javed Anfar says Israel has focused on targeting Iran's proxies.
But in order to get effective results, Israel has to attack the head of the octopus, which means attacking the interest of the Islamic Republic of Iran directly inside in its territory.
Last week, Israel's current Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, told The Economist that his country is in fact implementing the octopus doctrine. He said, we no longer play with the tentacles. We have created a new equation by going for the head. Meanwhile, Iranian officials have vowed to respond.
We Migirim.
We will take revenge for the blood of our beloved, the chief commander of IRGC, Hossein Salami, said. But could there be a way to de-escalate this standoff? Mayor Javed Anfar says there is one option for Israel and its allies.
The best strategy to end all this would be to negotiate with the Islamic Republic of Iran.
But that is not happening at the moment, he says, and it's unlikely that it will anytime soon. The U.S. and Europeans have been trying to negotiate a new nuclear deal with Iran after President Trump walked away from the previous one in 2018, but those talks appear to be stalled. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Coming up next, how the Fed's interest rate hike could ripple across the globe. You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. Inflation here in the U.S. has reached a 41-year high, and there are ongoing worries about stagflation in the U.S. and abroad. The U.S. Federal Reserve and the Biden administration are trying to avoid that at all costs. Here to break this down is The World's senior editor, Jason Margolis. Hey, Jason.
Hey, Carolyn.
First off, can you define stagflation? I'm having some serious Econ 101 flashbacks here.
Right. Well, it's a made-up term. It's a combination of the words stagnation and inflation. So inflation is when things cost more money to buy, plus stagnation, which means sluggish growth. And that can lead to high unemployment. That plagued the U.S. in the 1970s and early 80s. It's a situation you really want to avoid. And nations are worried that between the pandemic, supply chain disruptions, and the war in Ukraine, that it's a possibility. But central banks are much more sophisticated today. So the hope is that stagflation can be avoided.
And of course, the reason we're talking about this today is that the U.S. Federal Reserve just raised interest rates again by a lot, 0.75%. What is it trying to do here?
Right. That's the biggest rate hike in nearly 20 years. Basically, the Fed is trying to cool off the economy, making it more expensive to borrow money for everything from getting a mortgage to a new car loan. It also makes it more expensive for companies to invest in their factories or whatever it takes to grow. The downside to all of this is that cooling the economy can lead to a recession or job losses.
And I will never be able to afford to buy a house.
That's correct.
So obviously the global economy, you know, is tightly intertwined. What happens here has an impact in other places. When the Fed raises interest rates this much, what are some of the specific ripple effects that this is going to have in other countries?
Right. So we are the biggest economy in the world, and there are a lot of ripple effects when the Fed does this. So imagine you're a U.S. company that builds widgets in Mexico or Thailand or wherever. Now it's more expensive to borrow money to build those widgets, so you slow down your production. And that could cost some jobs in Mexico or Thailand. The other thing is that when interest rates rise, the dollar tends to get stronger. Now, that's good if you want to buy stuff from abroad or take a vacation in Europe. But it also means that other countries won't so easily be able to afford our exports. And that can hurt American companies, too. And then it starts to get really complicated really quickly. But basically, if the currencies of other countries get weaker, their central banks can raise interest rates, and that could cause economic pain in their countries also.
So the Federal Reserve works independently from the White House, and it's this truism that the president can't actually control the economy very much. Can President Biden do much about inflation specifically?
Not nearly as much as the Fed, but President Biden and his administration can do a few things. It could increase oil supplies, for example. And the administration is already releasing oil from the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve. That's starting in August, and that should lower prices at the pump by a little bit. Long term, the White House is trying to lower our energy bills. It's calling on Congress to pass clean energy and vehicle tax credits. That would be a way for us to save money on our utility bills. And the White House wants to lower prescription drug prices, lower food prices by helping American farmers. Then the Biden administration is considering lowering tariffs on goods from China.
So explain how that would work and what the intended effect would be.
Okay, so let's go back a few years. The Trump administration engaged in a trade war with China. It basically argued China was not playing by the rules, which it wasn't. So President Trump imposed tariffs on thousands of items coming from China. And a tariff is basically a tax. What that means is if a U.S. company wants to import Chinese-made jeans, a toy, or whatever from China, the importer, the American company, has to pay an extra tax to bring that item into the U.S. So make sense so far?
Yeah, and then basically consumers end up bearing a lot of that cost, right?
Exactly. So economists pretty much universally hated Trump's tariffs, arguing that they weren't effective. But back to today. President Biden inherited them, and he doesn't want to fold his cards at the poker table because China imposed retaliatory tariffs on American exports, too.
So if they're going to have tariffs, we need to have the tariffs.
Exactly. But the Biden administration is trying to lower prices for you and me, the American consumer, and removing those tariffs is one thing it can do.
So this is one of the tools that the White House has.
One of the tools. So the big windup, the answer to the question, will rolling back these tariffs lower costs for American consumers and lower inflation? Probably not much. Because once prices are higher and consumers have demonstrated that we'll pay a little extra for that Chinese jacket or sweater, most importers don't turn around and then lower prices. They just pocket the extra money for themselves.
Good for sellers, bad for consumers. The World's Jason Margolis, thank you for breaking this down for us.
All right. Thanks, Carolyn.
Norway's new national museum opened to the public this week in Oslo. It's been a long and difficult road to get there, with construction delays, cost overruns, and controversies dogging the new institution. But now that it's finally completed, critics say the museum presents Norway's cultural legacy in a new light. Reporter John Last has our story.
Norway's new national museum is famously not much to look at. A gray slate box topped by a luminous hall of glass, it's been compared to a castle, a bunker, and a prison, slammed by reviewers as closed off, arrogant, and, quote, incomprehensibly bad. Construction issues delayed the opening by 2 years, costing taxpayers millions. Workers on site complained of sexual harassment, underpayment, and poor working conditions. And at one point, the building's own architect threatened to boycott the opening.
And he also didn't like the opening exhibition. He called it actually a flea market.
Marianne Enge is the editor-in-chief of Kunstkritik, a Nordic art review magazine. She didn't like the building's look either. But inside, she says, the collection truly comes alive. Visitors are greeted by a giant tapestry of reindeer skulls, produced to protest quotas imposed on Norway's indigenous reindeer herders. It's one example of how the museum is diversifying its collection.
They are trying to present themselves as a museum for everyone and a museum that wants to represent everyone.
Of course, even the collection is not without its controversies. To fill the vast halls with contemporary art, the National Museum made an unprecedented partnership with the family of the richest person in Norway, the billionaire shipping magnate John Fredriksen.
In 2006, he renounced his Norwegian citizenship to avoid having to pay taxes to Norway. He is now a citizen of Cyprus. And now lately, he has also been in business with Vladimir Putin's Russia. He's very problematic, I think.
The decision to display the Fredriksen family's art collection has raised persistent accusations of art washing, trying to rehabilitate their image by sharing their vast collection with the public.
It's a dilemma. I can see that.
Randi Goda is the curator of contemporary art at the National Museum. While this kind of arrangement with private collectors is commonplace in the U.S., it's more unusual for Europe's state-funded museums. But Goda says it's one way to bring fresh money and fresh art into the gallery.
It's a partnership that has brought a lot of great artworks to the museum.
And in the grand scheme of things, the Fredriksen family collection is really only a drop in the bucket. The new National Museum actually combines the collections of what were once four different institutions. Its 87 galleries contain more than 6,000 items, offering visitors a look at everything from 11th century stained glass to the cutting edge of Norwegian design. Goda, who came from the old Museum of Contemporary Art, says that's freed curators to think outside the artificial distinctions between contemporary and modern, art and design, even if it has at times put them under the microscope.
Of course, there will be criticism. I don't think that will ever stop. But I think also it's a great museum, and I'm really proud of what we've done.
For The World, I'm John Last.
You're listening to The World. There's not a lot to laugh about in Ukraine right now, which might be exactly why people in Kyiv are going back to a comedy club. Just one rule, no talking about the war. People come and say for a while they forget about the fighting.
And felt happy and saw something fun and felt some joy.
Plus, why Sri Lankan government workers are now getting 3-day weekends. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH in Boston and PRX. There is an insidious force more dangerous than war, malaria, HIV, and car accidents combined. It's bad air. A new study puts a new number on the problem. It shows that air pollution worldwide is robbing us of a collective 17 billion years of life. That's several years per person in some places. The most affected people live in South and Southeast Asia. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports from Thailand.
All right, it's 6:30 in the morning, Bangkok, and I'm going for a jog. A jog at my local park in the city center. Other people have the same idea, jogging before the heat reaches 100 degrees Fahrenheit. I catch up to Rangsan Chanyawanit, getting in his run before heading to work at an IT consultancy. He's a regular here at this park. On some of the bad days, what's it like to come running out here?
On a bad day, I don't come. You can feel it in your throat after a while.
The gunk in the air. Go for a nice long jog, 90 minutes, and you take in as much air as a sedentary person breathes in one day. In a city like Bangkok, where the air is often not great, that means inhaling a huge dose of tiny particulate matter.
It can get into your lungs, but it can also get into your bloodstream and travel throughout your body, and that's really how it causes havoc.
Krista Hasenkope runs the Air Quality Life Index at the University of Chicago. Her team has measured that havoc around the world, and the results are scary. In India, if the air was clean, up to World Health Organization standards, the average person would live 5 years longer. In Bangladesh, 7 years. And in Southeast Asia's megacities, Jakarta, Indonesia, Hanoi, Vietnam, dirty air causes the average person to die roughly 3 years sooner.
My co-author, Michael Greenstone, likes to say that it'd be a global emergency if Martians came to Earth and sprayed some sort of substance that caused the average person on the planet to lose years of life.
Of course, it's us, humans, fouling up the air. What drives pollution in South and Southeast Asia is growth. People moving from farms to cities, using more cars, building more factories, and also, everyone's got to eat. So more crops are grown, and the waste, like useless rice straw, gets burned, sending black clouds into the air. Even when cities ground to a halt during the COVID pandemic, air quality didn't improve that much in many places. In countries such as Thailand, Hasenkope says, it continued getting worse.
I think that just shows what a stubborn problem pollution can be and really how much it requires a sustained effort and political and social will to tackle it.
In Bangkok, many people check the air quality index every day. It runs on a scale from 0 to 500, 0 being perfectly clean. Places like Manhattan or L.A. usually hover around 30 to 50. But anything over 100 is not great. Rangsan, the runner in Bangkok, says if the number gets that high, he'll stay inside.
I wonder if it's been quantified yet, right? Public health, what we're paying in terms of our lung tax.
Well, I've got bad news. For people like us living in Bangkok, it's taking 1.5 years off of our life.
That's not good news in the morning.
Sorry about that. Okay, here's some better news. Efforts in China, where the government launched a war on pollution more than a decade ago, have added 4 years to the average citizen's life. And in Southeast Asia, overall pollution levels are bad, with 99.9% of people breathing unclean air, but at least those levels seem to be stabilizing. But South Asia, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, that's a different story. Go to severe hotspots such as New Delhi, and bad air is wiping out nearly 10 years from the average person's lifespan. Again, here's Krista Hasenkope.
I would definitely reconsider jogging in Delhi if I had any sort of underlying condition. I would definitely think carefully about letting my child play outside on a highly polluted day in Delhi.
Of course, scientists say sitting still is bad for you too. So even in New Delhi, people jog, often with masks on and sometimes with red eyes and stinging nostrils. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
Mohammed El-Halabi has been in an Israeli prison for 6 years now on controversial charges. He's a former aid worker from the Gaza Strip, and today an Israeli court found him guilty of numerous crimes, including diverting some $50 million to Hamas, the Islamist militant group that rules Gaza. Halabi's case has attracted a lot of attention. Reporter Yardena Schwartz was at the courthouse in the Israeli city of Beersheba when this verdict was announced today and joins me now. Yardena, tell me more about this $50 million crime. What was Mohammed El-Halabi convicted of?
So Halabi was found guilty of diverting $50 million worth of aid money from International Christian Aid Group World Vision to Hamas. He was also found guilty of being a member of Hamas, which is labeled a terrorist organization by the U.S., the EU, Israel, and many other governments. Much of the evidence used to convict Halabi remains classified. Most of the hearings in this trial, which began in 2018, were held behind closed doors. And in issuing his decision today, the presiding judge said that Halabi had admitted the charges against him. He was referring to a jailhouse confession that Halabi and his lawyer say was made under the threat of physical violence from an undercover informant and shouldn't have even been admissible in court.
So I want to ask you about, you know, the controversies around this case in just a second. But first, just a little bit more background. Can you tell me what he was doing at World Vision, that Christian aid group, when he is said to have diverted these funds?
Halabi is a Palestinian aid worker and father of five. He was the head of World Vision's operations in Gaza, and he was on his way back from a routine meeting in Israel on June 15, 2016, when he was detained at the Gaza border by Israeli officials exactly 6 years ago.
But I understand that there wasn't even $50 million in his budget, basically, when he was working there. Is that right?
That's right, Carolyn. According to World Vision, the amount Halabi is accused of funneling to Hamas is double what they allotted to Gaza in that time frame. But after his arrest, World Vision suspended their operations in Gaza and carried out independent investigation, which found no evidence of wrongdoing. Australia, Germany, and the U.S. government also carried out audits of the funding because they're donors of World Vision, and they too found no evidence of mishandling of funds in their audits.
So what has the reaction been now that he's been convicted of this crime?
Sharon Marshall is with World Vision. She was at the court today. So here's what she had to say.
There have been irregularities in the trial process and a lack of substantive and publicly available evidence. We support Mohammed's intent to appeal the decision and call for a fair and transparent appeal process based on the facts of the case.
So there's likely to be an appeal. What about Mohammed El-Halabi himself? Has he made any comments throughout these proceedings?
Yeah, so you're right. There will be an appeal. His lawyer plans to appeal, and there still is no sentencing in this case. For the past 6 years, Halabi has insisted on his innocence. According to his lawyer, Israel has offered him numerous plea deals that would have seen him walk free by now, and he has rejected all of them. His lawyer and his father say Halabi has suffered what amounts to torture during his detention and that he's lost 50% of his hearing from being beaten in the head.
Oh, wow. And final question here. What sort of international reaction has there been to this case?
So the Biden administration has said that it's been following this case very closely. The UN Human Rights Office has also heavily criticized Israel's handling of the case. They issued a statement saying that international fair trial standards have not been met, and they say there's been enormous pressure on Halabi to confess in the absence of evidence.
Yardena Schwartz is a reporter based in Israel. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Carolyn. Great to be with you.
And now we've got a couple updates on stories we've been following. Last week, we spoke with airline passenger Dinesh Joseph. He's from South Africa and was traveling on his South African passport when this happened.
I was asked to go to the Ryanair customer service desk, gave my passport in, gave the boarding pass in to get stamped. And in return, I was presented with the Safrikaans test.
Ryanair was screening passengers with South African passports using a quiz about the country written in Afrikaans, the language of that country's apartheid era. And Joseph, like nearly 90% of South Africans, does not speak Afrikaans.
I don't understand why they would want people to do it and why they chose that language. who at Ryanair actually let this test out?
That question may never be answered, but Ryanair CEO Michael O'Leary told a press conference yesterday that the quiz was meant to screen out phony South African passports. He did not explain why none of South Africa's other official languages were used, but he confirmed that the test in Afrikaans has now been scrapped. And another update, this one too, about a story involving planes. This was the sound yesterday at a military airstrip on the outskirts of Amesbury in Wiltshire, England. The video shows an airliner parked on a tarmac. It was supposed to carry asylum seekers from places like Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, and Syria out of the UK to an offshore holding facility in Rwanda.
If their claim was successful, they would be allowed to stay in Rwanda for up to 5 years. If they failed, then they'd face deportation.
That was The World's Orla Berry telling me on Monday that while the government had planned for some 130 people to be sent abroad, all but 11 people succeeded in getting their deportation orders cancelled.
But then this afternoon, we heard the figures had dropped to single digits.
And then last night, as reporters were keeping an eye on the plane, the European Court of Human Rights ruled that one of the passengers would face, and I'm quoting here, a real risk of irreversible harm if he remained on the flight. That triggered a series of legal challenges in London courts, and by 10:15 last night, all the passengers had left the plane. British Home Secretary Priti Patel told the House of Commons today that the European court decision will not scrap this entire offshoring plan.
And preparations for our future flights and the next flights have already begun.
Patel said her team is reviewing each and every legal decision, and in July, the UK government's plan will get a full review by a British court. In Central Asia, Tajikistan is a post-Soviet country struggling to find its identity after a civil war. It's now governed by an authoritarian leader who jails dissidents. And many Tajik women say they face violence or neglect, especially when their husbands migrate to Russia for work. Still, reporter Fariba Nawa met some women in the capital of Tajikistan, Dushanbe, who were standing up to old traditions and trying to pave a new path forward.
Malika Jurakulova is in a rush to go to a social event, but her two daughters have just come back from school and they're hungry. She's giving them a choice for dinner, Tajik pilav or pizza. The girls, who are 9 and 12, choose pizza. Jurakulova is a divorced single mom and a women's rights activist. She has a warm smile and a unique clothing style with ethnic hand-woven dresses and coats. Jurakulova was a child during Tajikistan's civil war in the 1990s, shortly after the collapse of the Soviet Empire. Jurakulova comes from an upper-middle-class background, but her family struggled to eat on some days then.
That's the generation that didn't have the real childhood. I'm going to start crying right now. Like every time when I recall the time of the civil war, it's so much, I get so much emotional, honestly speaking. There was even the times when we didn't have bread.
But today, Jurakulova's thriving. At 38 years old, she's financially independent, working for a foreign organization on women's empowerment. Jurakulova speaks four languages and wants to make sure other Tajik women have opportunities like her.
At least I have a voice and I can sometimes scream on behalf of those women and girls who are discriminated, who are marginalized and vulnerable.
Tajikistan is the poorest among Central Asian countries, one reason why nearly 70% of women say they're targets of violence at home and on the streets. As an activist, Jurakulova spearheads campaigns against spousal abuse and sexual harassment. Jurakulova lobbies the city's mayor to implement the secular laws that protect and empower women and families. In 2017, women collected signatures to stop street harassment during the Me Too movement. Then police captured the harassers and made them clean the streets. The same men were shamed on social media. Jurakulova says she counts every positive step as progress. But the mentality against gender equality prevents further progress, Jurakulova says.
As the culture of shame, which is so widespread in Tajikistan, the patriarchal society that we have, that so many women really don't have voice, and this gender inequality is so much internalized by women and girls themselves.
Jurakulova says Tajiks who've embraced an extreme brand of Islam restrict women, and those who are influenced by portrayals of women by Russian media sexualize and objectify them. In the midst of this polarization, women are simply trying to survive.
It's very smart, the guy here, you know, like they pick up what they need from Islam and they just leave what they don't need, you know?
Jura Kluva says her own secular husband divorced her by saying talaq, or divorce, three times as a religious gesture. With her parents' support, Jura Kluva later took him to court for an official divorce on grounds of infidelity. But many other Tajik women divorce with no financial or emotional support. At a tailor shop on the outskirts of Dushanbe, several women work 10 hours a day, 7 days a week. Most of these women are their family's breadwinners. Shahnaza doesn't share her last name because it's shameful to talk about divorce. Shahnaza says she left her husband after he broke two of her arms. He already had another wife. Polygamy is illegal, but rampant here. Then he went to work in Russia. Shahnaza says, smiling, "We women work inside and outside the house. We can't meet our men's demands. When you're so tired, you can't serve your husband." The demands of women, especially young brides, are appalling, says Shahribanu Shonasimova. She represents the NGO British Charity International.
Daughter-in-laws are considered like labor force, and they are treated like slaves, not like a family member.
Shonasimova says some mothers-in-law forbid young brides from using cell phones. Shonasimova conducts workshops with both men and women to help them communicate better in their families.
We don't tell them what is good and what is bad, but we give them food for thought.
They use empathy to stop them from using violence against each other. Back in Jura Kluva's home, tea is ready after dinner. Jura Kluva says many educated Tajiks leave, but she's choosing to stay despite the danger of being arrested as an activist.
This country really needs people like me, like my friends who are civil activists, who are human rights defenders.
Jura Kluva has an urgent goal: to see those committing violence against women brought to justice in Tajik courts. For The World, I'm Fariba Banawa, Dushanbe, Tajikistan.
The National Geographic Society helped fund this story. Sri Lanka approved a plan this week to give government employees Fridays off. Now, it's got nothing to do with work-life balance. It's actually part of the government's response to its economic crisis. Joining me now from Sri Lanka's capital, Colombo, is Iswaran Ratnam. He's a reporter for the Sri Lankan newspaper, The Daily Mirror. Iswaran, I understand the four-day work week is about two things that are in short supply right now, food and fuel. Can you explain?
Yeah, so Sri Lanka is facing a serious shortage of fuel, and there is an impending food crisis as well. The food crisis has already taken shape. People are running out of essential items, and there is a shortage of fuel. And as a result, there's a shortage of public transport on the streets. So this has led the government to urge public workers to stay at home on Fridays. They've given Friday as a holiday so that people can stay at home. Of course, they want them to work from home. But the main intention here is to try to reduce the dependency on fuel, because the country is running out of fuel. The last stock is due on Thursday. And this is one reason that they've declared Friday a holiday for public workers.
And the government has also said that employees can use that day to also grow food to help ward off impending food shortages, right?
Yes, yes. So anyone with sufficient land can actually grow food and try to sustain themselves and anyone else that they can.
United Nations surveys indicate that 70% of Sri Lankans have had to reduce their food consumption, even skipping meals due to price hikes on food. What has been the change in the cost of a meal in Sri Lanka?
Well, the cost has skyrocketed. And one of the conditions there is that Sri Lanka needs to have some tax reforms, because the current administration feels that the former government had slashed taxes and that has hit the treasury in Sri Lanka. They don't have funds. So now they're raising taxes, and as a result, they've increased the cost of several items. Someone who would buy an egg in dollars, let's say if it was around, say, $1 now, it's double the cost. People can't buy rice because that has gone up as well. Rice is a staple food in Sri Lanka. So people are now having to pay twice as much as they did earlier for food, and most people can't afford that. These days, you see people actually going to the streets and donating food because of the serious issue that we are facing right now.
Wow, it sounds like it's just getting worse and worse there. Can you take a step back and remind us how we got here? What's causing this current economic crisis?
So it all started with the fertilizer ban that the incumbent president Gotabaya Rajapaksa imposed. When he found that we were running out of dollars, he assumed that banning the imports of fertilizer and other imports would help our foreign reserves. But that backfired, especially with the fertilizer, and then farmers found it difficult. There was no local harvest with rice crops and vegetables. So then that hit the local market. And then with no dollars, the fuel issue came up. And as a result, the government had to look at securing fuel supplies through credit lines. And Sri Lanka already has a debt issue. And now we are going out again and appealing to the international community to try and help us out. But then there's very little that most people can do. So right now it's becoming a situation where it's just going from bad to worse.
Iswaran, how are you managing? Are you able to get fuel and food? And what is your day-to-day like?
No, I've just parked my car at home. I've decided not to take it out because I'm almost out of fuel and there's no fuel at fuel stations in Colombo. Food-wise, I'm fine, but we have reduced as far as meat is concerned. We don't eat meat every day. We have reduced the items that we would have on our plate on a daily basis because we need to adjust to the current situation. I'm managing, but there are people who are far worse than me.
Well, good luck, and thank you so much for speaking to us. We've been speaking to Iswaran Ratnam from the Sri Lankan capital, Colombo. He's a reporter for the Sri Lankan newspaper, The Daily Mirror. Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure.
Ukrainians have a long tradition of humor, even, or maybe especially, in the face of tragedy. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky himself was a comedian. So even with a war going on, many say it's time to start joking again. Reporter Ashley Westerman brings us now to a city that's again taking some time to laugh.
It's my first time stand up, so I'm kind of anxious.
Before the war, Kyiv had a busy stand up and improv comedy scene, buoyed mostly by low cost outlets, amateur theaters, and the internet. This video was taken just days before the war at an open mic night at Pro English Theater, not far from Kyiv city center. The room is packed, even for stand-up in English. Audience members laugh as performer Anton Labada begins his routine.
Without further ado, my jokes and my stuff.
But when Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24th, the laughter stopped. The shows stopped. The performances stopped. The open mics stopped. For months. But as the war dragged on, now over 100 days, Kyiv did not fall into Russian hands. People who had fled the capital started coming home, and along with those who had stayed put, have started trying to live their lives again. Even laughing. At a show this weekend, the Rockstar Improv Troupe took the stage in a dark, damp, underground space. The audience, unmasked, sat shoulder to shoulder. In this scene, spoken in a combination of Ukrainian and Russian, an actor can't remember his lines. They try the scene again. And, as predicted, the actor cannot remember his lines again. The humor may have been lost in translation on this reporter, but the raucous crowd seemed to think it was pretty funny. Dmytro Vesuk is the troupe's audio mastermind. He and other members fled Kyiv when the shelling by Russians began, but have since returned and started performing again in early April. He says the war has been very difficult, emotionally, psychologically, and that comedy allows people to take that load off for a little bit. Additionally, he says, donations made at these events go to the Ukrainian armed forces, so they're also helping the war effort. outside the theater, troupe member Anton Gorgivsky says since they started performing again, they've done about a show a week.
We restarted it and slowly it reignited the flames.
He says his troupe has actively decided not to focus their content on the war. He says the audience is there to forget about reality.
They come, they say, oh, for an hour and a half, I forgot about the war and felt happy and saw something fun and felt some joy.
He says that it's important that their lives not be limited by war. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman in Kyiv.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Hi, this is Marco. Before I sign off, I want to remind you that The World is fundraising now through June 30th. Listeners like you support our work financially. Because of your help, our newsroom can focus our international reporting on people at the center of global events. Learn more and make your gift at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much. From PRX.